Ahoy, fine Worst Foot Forward listener. I hope that my voice rattling around your eardrums finds itself within the brain of a person who's had a good week. My, that was convoluted. I hope you're well, pals. Some lovely bits of news to kick off the week. We have a new member of our Patreon club to welcome, and he is a platinum-lined, ermine-trimmed member of the Patreon club. Hello, and thank you, John Robinson, for your very kind donation. He has become a £20 a month donor. A little more on what that means for him and for you in a moment. But just to say, John has done it in a financially sneaky and, for me and Barry, delightfully rewarding way. He's decided to give us an annual donation, which means that my eyes nearly popped out of my head when I saw that coming into the Worst Foot Forward Patreon account, but also means that John has got himself a cheeky little discount of I think 10%, it might be 15%. If you've listened to this show for enough time, you'll know admin not our strong point. But if you do want to donate to us and you fancy getting it all over and done with in one fell swoop, you can do it annually like John has, and indeed as our other donor this week, Jennifer D'Souza, has. Jennifer has already been supporting us to the tune of, it was either $2 or $3 a month. She's bumped that up to a fiver a month, paid for in one lump sum, and that means she gets to choose a topic of her choice for us to talk about. And we're going to talk about the world's worst misunderstanding, I think. We do now have quite a lot of Patreon suggestions stacking up. We still have to come and to record over the next few months. The world's worst patron, the world's worst vegetable, the world's worst Eurovision song, the world's worst composer, and John's suggestion, the world's worst pop star. Now, as you may be aware, because John has given us 20 quid a month, as well as suggesting the topic, he's also allowed to come on the show as a guest judge, as you would be if you donated a tenner a month. And up until this very weekend, he would have been welcome onto the show as a guest, which we have done for some previous patron donors. But we're slightly changing what we're going to be doing for you premium lot. Instead of that, we're going to do what we've given for our competition winners and as Christmas presents in the past. John is going to get his own privately curated Worst Foot Forward episode. He's given us some basic details about him and his family, and me and Barry are going to go down to the Worst Foot Forward vaults and see what oddball trivia we can find out to garland their brains with. So if you like the sound of that, and you can by all means still ask for it as a gift for yourself or a gift for a loved one or an enemy, but from now on, if you're kind enough to donate 20 quid a month our way, then that's what you're getting. You're very welcome on the show as a judge and as a topic suggester, but your extra little cherry on top of the ice cream sundae of patronage is that we will give you your own personal private episode. And we hope that'll be quite the enticing offer. Safe to say, we are teetering on the point of our next Patreon goal. We're just a few away, I think three or four, from achieving 70 supporters. And when we hit that, we're going to put on a very special live show, hopefully in the flesh, if this vaccination business goes well and against the theme of the show. We're going to put on a Worst Foot Forward symposium where we'll get some of our favourite guests from the past to come and perform songs, scenes from movies and plays, poetry, maybe make works of art based on suggestions and winners from previous shows. If you would like to see that happen live, and I imagine we will video it too, head to patreon.com/worstfootforward where you can support us, get extra material, see our regular monthly knockoff Taskmaster Challenge, and even read excerpts of our soon-to-be-thrown-before-publishers-and-agents book. Me and Barry, well, I'll give you an update on that. Me and Barry have written our, I think, seventh draft of an intro. We're on to the third draft of his chapter. They are both looking pretty sparkling, and I have to get my nose to the grindstone and finish my homework and nail the third draft of my chapter. And I think once me and Barry have gone through that and dotted all the F's and crossed all the P's, then we'll be ready to send it before people who we think might enjoy it. And who knows? In a few months' time, you guys might get to be the patrons of not just a podcast, but a book. Exciting times. It seems like there may be light at the end of the tunnel, and it's not an oncoming train. I think that's all. Welcome, John. Thank you, Jennifer, for reaffirming your commitment to the Worst Foot Forward cause. And we hope that you enjoy this week's episode with, as you will hear in the introduction, thricely returning Anna Porshaisky. She is, as ever, wise, funny, erudite, charming, and very silly indeed. And we hope that you enjoy this deeply crafty episode.
Hello and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, where we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Barry McStay, and each week I, my co-host and our guest, propose our candidates for the title of the world's worst something. For this week's episode of Worst Foot Forward, boys and girls, you'll need some sticky back plastic, toilet roll inserts, an old washing up liquid bottle, and 15 pounds of Semtex. You should definitely ask for a grown-up's help with this one, if only to give you plausible deniability. And alongside me, covered in glue, glitter and pasta shapes, but that's just normal for a parent of two toddlers, he's the one I made earlier. It's Ben van der Velde.
Hello, Barry. Hello, friends at home. That is so true. If you want to know what the most resilient substance on earth is, it is not diamonds and it is not a cockroach's gusset. It is glitter that is used by toddlers. Yeah. And today, I went for my first swim since December because plague. And I couldn't find my goggles anywhere until I found in a tote bag that had previously been used to send a Passover card to my parents. And I'm sure you and the listeners don't realise quite what an essential part glitter plays in the Passover story in the mind of my son. But I took the goggles out and all I can say is that I just had the most fabulous swim this morning. It was like I had the Liberace filter on my goggles.
So good. My older brother had his wife had a child in the past year. I get sent videos, as you do, from family members of, you know, the baby is moving in this direction today, or the baby has rolled onto this side of their body. I got one a couple of months ago of the baby is sitting in his high chair, putting his hand into a bowl of paint and then daubing it on a sheet of card, and he's doing art now. And I said, no, what you're doing there is reinforcing to him is that things in bowls should be splattered with your hand and rubbed on flat surfaces, making meal times an even bigger nightmare.
That is the risk with handprint art. Yeah. But what you're going to do if you try to explain to him the notions of Pointillism and chiaroscuro, they just get angry. Tried to explain it, but like our little ones are not having any.
Very
bit.
Difficult to impose perspective on a 2-year-old.
Yeah.
In more ways
of
than
all
one.
Kinds. Yeah. Let us introduce this week's guest. Our guest is an award-winning material scientist, writer, and storyteller, as well as being the sort of reliable podcast guest you could bend a horseshoe around. She is a materials generalist, equally fascinated by metals, plastics, ceramics, glasses, and substances from the natural world, making her both a functioning scientist and an actual magpie. Her first book, Handmade, A Scientist's Search for Meaning Through Making, is out in May 2021, and that is entirely coincidental with her appearance on today's show. In her spare time, she channels her inner James Brown by playing the trumpet in a funk and soul covers band, but obviously not for the past 12 months because that would make her an extremely dangerous vector, and is also an ultra-endurance open water swimmer, which she channels by swimming the actual channel. She is the ultimate Renaissance woman, equally at home in a forge, a recording studio, or a swimming pool, and could probably rewrite a Bible, poison a sibling, or hold off the Ottoman hordes if required. She is also extremely at home on this podcast, having previously appeared on our World's Worst Material show and at our one and only live show, which was the catalyst for the plague. And now, returning as our first ever three-time guest, channeling herself, is Dr. Anna Porshaisky.
Hello! Thanks so much for having me back again.
I feel like a bit like the original Jules Rimet trophy, you get to keep the podcast now.
Yes!
It's the first three-time appearer.
That is true, but that also means that a sneaky little dog is going to try and steal Anna, and then the England football captain is going to get an awful lot of trouble. That's some absolutely banging 1970s World Cup lore for probably about 20% of our listenership. Yeah.
I like the fact that you go, oh, you're interested in all sorts of substances, which sounds slightly dodgy, actually, when you were listing it there, Ben.
Yes, it does. Which is, come on, I know we've... We had you on the show, Anna, to talk about what is the worst material, and from time to time, me and Barry do shows where you pick the best of things when, you know, it all gets us down. So what, Anna, is the best material?
There's just so many choices. I think last time I came on, I said that the worst material was graphene, right? Because it's so massively overhyped and everybody thinks it's going to save the world. And really, it's just like extremely weak and flimsy and we can't really make it very well. Mm-hmm. So I think for me, the best materials are ones that get overlooked, that don't get their sort of place in the spotlight like graphene does. And in my sort of adventures writing the book, I looked at 10 different materials. And for me, my favorite one of those was wool. And wool is just an absolutely like mind-blowingly, crazily, intricately formed material. And it is so because, you know, like evolution has given nature millions and millions of years to create these structures and materials that are like perfectly suited for what nature wants to do with them. And so wool is a material that we as material scientists have never, ever been able to replicate as well, right? Like we've all worn a woolly jumper made of actual wool and then like a shit fleece made from polyester.
Yeah.
Like it doesn't have any of the sort of like thermal properties. It hasn't got any of the properties that makes it breathable yet lightweight, all this sort of stuff. So I'm going to say that the best material massively overlooked is wool.
Incorrect. It is velour.
Tell me why.
Because it feels so nice.
Getting very Ed Wood there, Ben.
Yeah. Because, well, the thing with wool is that, I mean, there's not many animals that make wool. It's sheep, alpacas, llamas. Do goats count as wool?
No, I think goat is goat hair, isn't it?
It's such a strange and unique substance. It's one of those things, I think, because we're so used to everyone wearing a woolen jumper and we're all taught what a sheep is from the age of three, even if we live in an inner city tower block, that we don't think of wool as being quite a weird and unique thing, even though it clearly is.
Yeah, massively.
I think we've mentioned on the show before that the reason that the Speaker in the House of Lords sits on the wool sack, which is... it's just a cushion with wool in it. And I think it was originally something the Lord Chancellor would sit on. And I think it was Edward III, like, made this symbol for the Lord Chancellor to sit on as, like, symbolising how important the wool trade was to England's economy in the Middle Ages. And the thing I remember about that is a bit later on, Queen Elizabeth I, the reason we eat mint sauce with lamb is Queen Elizabeth I wanted to discourage people from eating lamb and mutton. So she passed a law saying you had to have bitter herbs with them if you wanted to eat them, because apparently in the 16th century mint wasn't appealing to the palate when paired with lamb. So she wanted to help the wool trade by stopping people eating lamb and mutton, so she passed a law insisting people add mint sauce to it.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, which is,
there you go, Anna. Barry's just nice. Added a footnote to your already published book.
Recall all copies.
Also, I don't know how I'd feel about the Queen telling me how to eat my dinner. Like, I feel like if that happened now, no one would do it.
It would all have to be black, presumably. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say at the moment, I presume we're all eating a charcoal diet three times a day out of respect for
it.
Indeed.
It would be disrespectful to order in a biryani in the current climate.
Well, not unless you say something extremely rude to the delivery driver when he drops it off.
Anna, we usually ask people what they're worst at in the world, but maybe in light of your book, what craft are you worst at in the world?
Yeah, with each material, I sort of meet a maker and go and like try my hand at what they do. In the steel chapter, I go and meet a blacksmith and have a go at blacksmithing, pottery, stonemasonry. And I'm pretty pants at all of them, I have to say, because the story of the book is that, you know, my background is in material science and I'm very much like a bookworm. I know all the theories of materials and kind of how they're put together. I can draw the graphs and stuff. But actually, if you asked me to make something practical or, you know, try and sort of get hands-on in any way with materials, then I'm completely lost, because that's all I know is about them on paper rather than in the real world. So each chapter I've got my hands on these materials and learned from craftspeople about how they like work with them. And in the chapter on wood, I had a go at spoon carving with a wood expert called Barn the Spoon in East London. And I went to a day-long wood carving workshop and learned how to carve spoons out of wood.
Is that with those like little curved knives?
Yeah. So there's a straight knife and there's a question mark shaped knife to spoon out the middle of the spoon.
That's very meta.
A spoon to spoon the spoon. Yeah.
That is the world's easiest tongue twister as well. Who spoons the spoon makers? The spoon maker's husband. That's who.
So how did that go?
Well, quite badly, it turns out. So what I didn't realize when I started out on this whole thing was that like art really represents the maker, and sometimes it represents them at quite a deep psychological level, which maybe you might not want to display to the world, depending on your state of mind at the time. So in that workshop, I made three spoons. I'm going to show it to you guys on this video and we'll describe them. This was my first spoon. Right.
That's reasonable.
So it's reasonable. It's okay. But what happened was I went against the advice of Barn the Spoon, because he said, don't soften the edge of the spoon, because the line around the top side of the bowl of the spoon is like what gives the spoon its aesthetics. And I was like, well, that sounds uncomfortable for eating, so I'm going to like slice it off. And basically what happened was I sliced off too much. And so now if I show it to you from the side, there's like a huge sort of dip, like gouge out of the bowl of the spoon. So basically, if you're going to eat soup out of this, it's all going to spill out of the sides.
Got you. But to listeners at home, it looks like a smallish wooden spoon, but it's got a little like dent hanging out on one bit near where the shaft meets the bowl bit.
Yep.
To listeners at home, it looks like Anna has done a raid on the Paleolithic cabinet at the British Museum.
Yep, I think that's pretty accurate. When I was talking about the sort of the psychological revealingness of this sort of thing, I always think that I know best.
Right. Yes.
I wouldn't say rebel, because let's be honest, I'm still like a nerdy scientist, but like going back on what I'd done before and trying to edit it and make it better, but actually being like quite destructive at the same time. That was that spoon.
Okay.
Yeah. So at lunchtime that day, I was like, fuck, I'm so disappointed with my first spoon. So then I made like a perfect, like teacher's pet version of the spoon. It followed exactly all of the instructions to the letter and made just a textbook spoon. Yeah.
Like from the side, that's like, it's like, it's the same thickness the whole way too, even where the shaft becomes the bowl. It's so flat and
Right.
I love it.
So that was me like very quickly trying to get back in favor with the teacher.
Yeah.
Because I have authority issues. And then the third spoon was one that I was just allowed to do whatever I wanted. Like we were given like a block of wood and told to like design our own thing. And it is so ugly. Like I have no artistic eye whatsoever. It's like the top of the spoon, the bit that you've put in your mouth, is massive and like square shaped.
Yeah.
And then it's got this really chunky neck that's like almost fatter than the handle and the bowl of the spoon.
Yeah.
And that makes it so heavy that it's really, really uncomfortable to hold. So
So freestyling and improvisation,
not my thing.
Not so much.
No, not so much. So that was my first experience with spoon carving, and I did get the bug actually, because I'm a perfectionist. So I was like, oh, maybe my next spoon could be better. So I got hold of my own tools. Right, I'm also a bit of an obsessive. I got hold of my own tools and I started doing my own wood carving. And in lockdown, I would go and meet my old colleague in, you know, the cemetery park at Tower Hamlet Cemetery Park. It's like beautiful wood. We'd go and sit there and we'd carve wooden spoons. And this is this is the one that I carved during that time. It's sort of like a awful stunted scoop.
Thing is, Anna, if this didn't have the context of you being a material scientist, it would sound like you'd had a very odd lockdown meltdown.
Yes, there were quite a lot of meltdowns going on. Barry, the fact that you're laughing quite so hard is a bit triggering to me, and we'll cover that in a sec.
Okay, sorry. I'm so sorry. The thing that's getting me is that you're two people carving spoons in a cemetery, which looks like you've got a very long grave digging game on your minds.
That is fair. So this spoon is unfinished. The reason that it's unfinished is that because of sort of the nature, the shape of the spoon, and the fact that I'm a right-handed person, you tend to hold the spoon in your left hand and you'll push round with the knife to shape it. But because the spoon isn't symmetrical the other way around, if you want to carve the other side of the bowl, I thought, well, maybe I'll just swap hands and use this extremely sharp knife with my left hand.
Ah.
And immediately I chopped the top off my thumb knuckle really deeply. really deeply.
At least you had something to catch all the blood in, I guess.
So I had a sanitary towel and my jumper. Yeah. So I was sitting there in this cemetery, like holding my hand over my head, like clasping a sanitary towel to myself. Meanwhile, there's all these like lockdown dogs that people have got that they can't control because they've never had a dog before, like coming up to me, like sniffing the blood, like, oh, what's going on here?
Something's going on here.
Sounds like you were like trying to hold some sort of Wicca ceremony.
It very much would have looked like that. Blood dripping on the ground, yeah. Sawdust all around. Yeah.
Yeah. Summoning dogs to you, your familiars.
I mean, what you're describing is just like a perfect lesbian weekend away. But...
Last time we had Anna on the show, we talked about the world's worst material. But yeah, I think in light of the book, we're going to go a little more specific. What is the world's worst craft? Ben, you're the first person to present what you've made to the class.
Thank you very much. A simple in and out, the cheese slice. Done. Craft have absolutely ruined that. I had an absolute mare. Now, when I first thought about this, I was immediately reminded of one of my favourite characters from Terry Pratchett's Discworld. In the book The Truth, which is all about the coming of the newspaper to the disc, the proprietor of the newspaper has to go and find some paper, and the guy who runs the paper mill is this chap who started off as like an urchin on the streets collecting rubbish that he would take to the tip, and eventually has become master of the paper mill and the junkyard and also the tannery. He's a guy called Harry King, and he's a fantastic character, but Pratchett goes into quite a lot of detail about how disgusting tanning is. And when you read about it, it is gross. It is, because it is all about the processing and treatment of skins and hides of animals. So this has been going on for tens of thousands of years. Obviously, if you're going to make a skin wearable by someone who's not a caveman and also change its colour, you need to de-hair it, de-grease it, de-salt it. You need to get rid of the fat and any blemishes in it, and in any sense that it was once a living, breathing, mooing animal.
And as humans, one of the first experiments we carried out was, would pissing on it help? Turns out it did. Right.
Listen, it's what we call the jellyfish reflex, and and it turns out in history, occasionally pissing on something is the right answer. If it's a jellyfish, if it is an animal hide, if it's an East German sex tourist, those are the three occasions at which it's all right to piss on something. If something's on fire, well, do you know what? I don't know. I appreciate you're a material scientist here, Anna, but as the most qualified person here, pissing on a fire, good, bad, indifferent?
As long as it's not an electrical fire, yeah, fine.
What if you can piss foam?
God. If you can piss carbon dioxide, then it's fine. Okay. Yeah.
I feel like somewhere out there is a Shaolin monk who is able to realign the chakras so that he can briefly breathe out of his urethra in order to starve a fire of oxygen. I apologise to anyone in the Shaolin monk community. The Shaolin monk community. Fuck.
And that takes us back to tide hide tanning.
Yeah.
Yes, it does.
let me take you through some of the process. So skins will arrive at the tannery and they'll be dried stiff and dirty with soil and gore and viscera. So the ancient technique was they'd be soaked in water to cleanse and soften them, and then the skins would be pounded and scoured. They've got, I think, these sort of like crescent shaped knives to scour them to remove the flesh and the fat, which obviously good profit there, sell it off. Then the hair's removed by soaking it in piss, and then it's painted with alkaline lime mixture, which is also disgusting. Or the skin's just allowed to putrefy for several months before dipping it in a salt solution. Then after the hair is removed, the tanners do something called baiting the material, which is softening it, by pounding dung into the skin or soaking it in a solution of what part of an animal?
Brains.
Correct, Anna. Oh, how did you know that?
I'm a material scientist that's been bathed in the world of craft for 4 years.
Fair. It's material scientist. It's what we do. We're closer to Victor Frankenstein than you'd think.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and often the most common form of dung that would used would either be dog turds. So there would be people who would wander the streets of Victorian London picking up dog turds and being like, oh, there's the money, or pigeon guano. And of course, in one of our episodes, yonks ago, we talked about pigeon guano encrusted islands, I think out in the Pacific, being used to fund terrible musicals.
Yes, I think they were called pure finders, the Victorian street wanderers who'd pick up feces, which makes it sound very Victorian, makes it sound much classier as
yes,
a job.
Yes, it really does. The sort of thing you can actually talk about at a Victorian dinner party. There is quite a famous tannery. Obviously, very important to make sure you say tannery and not tanning salon, because two very different things. But, there's one in Marrakesh. And another in, I can't remember, it's either India or Sri Lanka. And there's these incredible aerial shots of them because there's these enormous tubs that are probably the size of several double beds. And they've all got incredibly rich colours in them, like vermilion and violet and turquoise that I guess at the end of the process. And obviously, viewed from a helicopter through a telephoto lens, excellent. Working in them and then going, honey, I'm home. All right, I'll fetch the jet washer. Not as fun.
I interviewed a hide tanner in rural Ontario this week, funnily enough, and he told me that apparently in the Old Testament it says that the only time that a wife doesn't need an excuse to divorce her husband is if her husband is a hide tanner.
That's great. At that point, the rabbinic authorities are like, fair enough, he is a disgusting schmuck.
Amazing.
I know, amazing.
I then looked to see if I could find something more skin crawling as a substance, and I happened upon a chap called Jack Munro, not the tremendous bootstrap cook, but a British architect. He wanted to see if he could use blood in an interesting way. And so he created bricks made out of cow's blood.
Oh, wow.
And what he did, he mixed it with sand, water, preservatives, and an anticoagulant to stop it scabbing, because there's nothing worse than going up to a building made out of cow brick, blood bricks, and like just, you can't resist scratching the scab and then blood just gushes in your face. And then put it in a mold, baked it, using exactly the same process as clay bricks. And yeah, he has not yet made a house entirely of blood bricks, but that is his aim. And he claims that it's a way of creating affordable housing in case clay becomes scarce.
I mean,
cows give us milk. Could he try not to, could he try make the bricks out of milk instead of like having to cut the cows open?
Oh, I think that'll get a bit smelly after a while. I mean, so might blood bricks as
I don't know, yeah. We've mentioned before himself, the sculpture by Mark Quinn, which is just his own head made of blood. I think it's in frozen silicon, and it's in the National Portrait Gallery, and that he renews it every 5 years to sort of make a new mould of himself, and people can see him changing, which is very cool.
Good Lord, that's a hell of a blood transfusion.
Yeah, it's about 10 pints, I think. It's a lot.
That's what I'd need to do it. We talked about wool earlier on, Anna, and I tried to find ridiculously priced tailoring.
Yeah.
And the one that made me most angry were Falker Vicuna gentleman's socks. How much do you think you would pay for their pair of gentleman socks?
What's it made of? Do we get any hint?
Okay, I'll tell you what it's made of. It's something called a vicuna is an animal, which I believe is quite similar to an alpaca.
Yeah. I mean, it's got to be something really annoying. What I would pay for woolly socks is 10 quid for three pairs in a three pack. Martin Sparks.
I think the max I would pay for a really top quality pair of woolly socks is 20 quid.
Well, we've both learned what the algorithms are listening into this recording and now know exactly how to target you guys. $1,000 a pair, my friends.
No. 500 quid for one sock. No.
Apparently, these animals create the best yarns and they're...
really good story. They're no Billy Connolly, but they can spin a tail.
Unbelievable. One vicuna, they produce 1 pound of wool and it's too delicate to be dyed, so the socks are only available in one colour, which is brown.
You know, the Henry Ford of sock production.
Yeah. Each pair is custom made, tailored to the wearer's foot.
Well, it's clearly not custom made. Sorry, that's bollocks, because you can only have it in brown.
Custom made to your foot's proportions.
Right.
But not your preferred colour. And shipped to you in an elegant wooden box, which you can then...
So the socks cost a tenner. The wooden box is made from the finest mahogany.
Yeah, but it's the vicunas that have made the box as well. And you know how hard that is without opposable thumbs.
Yeah, did they knit the socks as well?
Yeah, they crocheted them between their two tiny horns.
Oh, that's adorable.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah, I would actually
that's generally 1,000 quid. See that.
But for my suggestion, I wandered off into Etsy and just went, what's the weirdest shit I can find here?
Right.
You know, there's people, you can get ornaments with tarantulas and cockroaches inside. Fine, we sort of covered that in our World Tourist Fashion Accessory episode with Tulip Sadiq. There is a world of icky and cuddly knitted anatomy where you can have pretend vivisectioned frogs and mice, but knitted. But far and away my favourite, this both delighted and infuriated me, is the page Terrible Origami. And in their words, this puts the OMG into origami. And this is basically, as far as I can see, scrunched up bits of paper that sell for $100 a time. And people are told that they are things. So you can buy, looking at their site now, there's my favourite is a fortune cookie accordion, which I will share with you guys now what the fortune cookie accordion looks like. would you like to describe for the listeners what you've seen?
It's a thin strip of paper, which presumably is the motto from inside a fortune cookie, that someone has folded into three zigzags.
Correct.
And it's currently retailing for 87 quid.
Yep.
Exactly. That's what you make when you're back in the olden days, when you're around a table at the Chinese restaurant of 20 people, everyone wants to pay on card individually for what they had. And you're there for 15 hours while everyone's paying. And so you scrunch up your fortune cookie thing into a little accordion.
Next up, we have a steampunk tissue bracelet. Let's see what you guys think of this. would you care to describe what you've seen there, friends?
Bit of tissue paper scrunched up and into a strip and turned around at each end so they meet. Sorry, Ben, have you seen Million Dollar Frog on that website?
I have.
Have you looked at it closely? Its current price is £37,890.27. It's a 4 foot long by 4 foot wide, like quite a reasonable origami frog. Made from 100 sheets of cardstock, 6 rolls of green apple duct tape. And wow. The person who's made it has put a note on it saying, Etsy will only let me set a price as high as $50,000. Rest assured, I am selling this for $1 million. set quantity 20 in your cart when you check out. There is only one frog. Just pretend like you're ordering 20 so we can work around this flaw in Etsy software.
This is astonishing. This is like a non-fungible token, but that it is actually a real thing.
Yeah, it's like it's quite a standard origami frog, but it's just like...
That is incredible.
That is amazing. I love that. I love and hate everything about that.
The Comedy Arcade is a panel show game of competitive anecdotes hosted by Vic Slayton, featuring a veritable fruit machine of ever-changing funny people, including, but not limited to, Shafiq Al-Sandy, Mark Watson, Josie Long, Sean Walsh and Russell Cain.
The first day of lockdown, I shat my pants in public.
I have a full-body latex catsuit that I bought for myself, and that is a fucking pleasure.
He did not mean his penis, and I sort of wish he had.
And I told her about it. I said, you know what, he wrote me this song, and it wasn't even nice. It was all about how he's a virus. And she went, that's my song.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. You can find it wherever good and bad podcasts abound. See you soon.
I mean, there are so many crafts that I found when I sort of delved into this whole world that are just very questionable. Most of them sort of quite bleak and quite sort of their cost to society pretty high. So I've got three for you here and I'll let you choose which you think is the worst. The first one is actually along the same lines as what you were talking about, Ben, with your hide tanning, mm-hmm. Is parchment making. In the history of paper is a material that has obviously like impacted society massively. But in the early days, there was sort of, it might not have been paper that actually sort of made it to be so ubiquitous. There were sort of three substances that were kind of rivals around the world that were trying to become kind of the world's sort of data storage solution. Mm. So the first was papyrus in Egypt. And they would sort of layer up the papyrus reeds and be able to make these great big scrolls. But the problem was that they couldn't really take the scrolls beyond sort of North Africa and the Mediterranean because the climates there were too wet. And so the scrolls would start going moldy. And also they're quite brittle. So you can't roll them up into like a sort of small data storage thing. And you can't make books out of them because they split. So that was a problem with papyrus. And then the Chinese invented paper and they were sort of the predominant paper makers for centuries. And the technology sort of spread west along sort of with the Islamic world and the Arab sort of empires. And they were using paper for sort of bureaucracy, really, and just sort of general admin, I suppose. But in Europe, the predominant sort of paper-like substance was parchment. And that was because they had this very wet climate, so they couldn't use papyrus. The Arab Empire kept trying to sell paper to the Europeans, but they kept refusing because they liked parchment so much. And parchment is made from animal skins in a very similar process to what you were describing, Ben. So at this time, so we're talking about the medieval period here, and pretty much the only books that were being made were sort of religious texts, generally the Bible in Europe, and sort of one or two sort of governmental bureaucracy type things, probably the Magna Carta is parchment, I guess. Big important books like that. Guess how many sheep it takes to make one parchment Bible?
One parchment Bible.
Now, is this Old Testament and New Testament?
I don't know enough about the Bible to say.
Okay, Old Testament is the one that we wrote where God is a bit of an asshole, and New Testament is the one that the Christians are into where he sends down his hippie son to try and make amends with the world.
Right, probably New Testament then.
Yeah. Okay.
70. I'm going with roughly, it's there's 66 books in the whole Bible. I'm going about just over a sheep a book.
How many sheep made the Bible? I would say...
How many typewriters did they have?
They had to learn from the vicunas how to operate them without their opposable thumbs. I'm going to say that the average medieval Bible was made of 300 sheep.
You're the closest. It's 200 sheep.
Wow.
200 sheep for one Bible.
Do you think they had specific Bible sheep farms? How did they choose? How did they choose the sheep who got turned into a Bible? It's just kind of like, was there a sheep lording it around us going, bah? I say, and bar unto you. And they're like, that one over there.
The particularly pious sheep get chosen. I mean, thinking about what we were talking about, wool earlier, you know, the fact that wool was extremely important to, it was slightly after the medieval period, but still very important to the economies at the time. I would think that the two industries would be pretty well aligned, because when you make parchment, you remove all of the wool off the sheep. So
yeah, that's true. Yeah, they're probably working hand in hand.
Mm.
They should have, if they wanted, you know, lined parchment, they could have used zebras.
Well,
fun fact, zebra skin is striped, by the way. It's not just the fur.
Cool.
It's not just their fur is striped. If you take the fur off, the skin is striped underneath it.
Yeah, it's the same as giraffe skin as well. It's got the same sort of a mottled pattern underneath it.
Yeah.
Nice. So yeah, well, actually, parchment was made not just in Europe, obviously, like sort of sub-Saharan Africa, parchment was the predominant writing source there, writing material there as well. Paper was only really accepted in most places because of the invention of the printing press, and you couldn't really fit parchment in a printing press properly. And it was also very expensive and took loads of sheep to make. So it was only really with the invention of mass-produced writing materials that paper actually was accepted in Europe.
The first time that computer drives came out that had HDMI and people were trying to shove the new cables in them, when the printing press came out, there was people going up to William Caxton going, I can't fit my sheep inside this. I don't know. I haven't got the right adapter for it.
Someone said, have you tried to, like, I can fit something smaller like a mouse. Oh, that gives me an idea.
Yeah. So that's what, right, parchment making, terrible craft, slaughters all the sheep. Not cool. The second option is porcelain, which again has a quite a sort of bleak societal outlook, because porcelain, actually, like what I learned in this through writing this book, is most materials were invented by the Chinese and then adopted by everyone else. So porcelain, again, was a Chinese material. It's why we have the China cup, and because of porcelain. And they were sort of the big experts in sort of ceramics, and particularly these very fine ceramics, for thousands of years. And at the start, it was just sort of like small cottage industries localized to local towns. But eventually around the year 1000 AD, it sort of all got organized around this town called Jingdezhen, where they had this huge mountain of kaolin, which is a type of white clay, which is what porcelain is made out of. Mm. So this town was sort of like the global epicenter for porcelain production. Over time, and through trading routes and all that sort of stuff, the porcelain wares sort of got taken along the Silk Road through Asia and eventually ended up in Europe. And there, the Europeans were like, oh, this is classy stuff. We quite like this new drink of tea from Asia. We quite like drinking it out of porcelain cups too. But the Chinese were really sort of restricting their exports. And so this stuff became known as white gold, because it was so rare to come by, but so desirable. And eventually the Europeans got sort of a bit fed up with having to sort of pay so much money for all of this porcelain. So they went about trying to find out the Chinese secret. And the Chinese really kept the recipe and how they made this stuff like really highly secret. So the Europeans were like, right, how are we going to find out what's going on here? In Germany, they were just sort of experimented. There were all these sort of alchemists and scientists in sort of the 1700s-ish, who they were like just experimenting in their workshops, trying to sort of crack the Chinese secret.
Well, that's the worst thing that they could have done.
Exactly. No, they didn't get very far because it all kept cracking.
Gunther, I've cracked it. Ah, not again, Hans.
Not again. So yeah, they invented a very, very similar type of material to the Chinese stuff. And so they up popped a little factory there, and they were very happy to just sort of start producing. The French took the approach of just going to China and asking them how to do it, right? Not mess around. Let's just go and ask them and see.
I mean, that makes a lot of sense.
It does. It does. So yeah, this sort of Jesuit priest from France just went to China, and he sort of converted some of the Jingdezhen workers to Christianity, and then was like, by the way, now that we're friends, do you want to show me how this works?
I've told you about Jesus. You can tell me to your economic empire.
Right? Classic Europeans.
Yeah.
So that was that. So the French sort of had the Chinese secret. The English, meanwhile, again, were sort of experimenting with how to make their own. And all these little porcelain factories started popping up, making this so-called hard paste porcelain, whereas the Chinese stuff was called soft paste porcelain. It's all pretty similar stuff. But so these English porcelain makers were, again, there was bitter rivalries between them because they all had their own sort of recipe. And they, it was very sort of a jealously guarded secret, and they didn't want to share their own particular formulation with the others, because it was very, there was a big competition in England because this stuff was so valuable. And one method in the Bow porcelain factory just down the road from me here in Stratford was to put bone ash into the porcelain. Yeah. Because the factory was just next to the slaughterhouses of Essex, and there was an excess of bone ash. So that is the origin of bone china, is literally like grinding up the burned bones of cows and putting it into a ceramic material.
So medieval Bibles, not vegan.
Victorian, not vegan.
Victorian porcelain, not vegan.
Not vegan either. So true. So true. Yeah.
The thing that really tickles me about that is obviously we call it China because it originated in China. So you could be like drinking out of a Switzerland cup.
Yeah.
If history had been different.
So true. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mother's coming. Bring out the finest Switzerland.
Exactly, exactly. Or the finest Stoke-on-Trent, indeed.
Yes, because, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, a lot of pottery in there.
Yeah, yeah. This whole sort of pantomime in Europe about like trying to get the secret was it kind of got to ridiculous levels, because there's stories of the English pottery makers sort of stowing themselves away inside barrels to try and infiltrate the ranks of the other pottery makers to like spy exactly how many bone cows they were putting into their mixture and stuff.
Pity the poor spy who gets delivered in a barrel to the tanners instead by accident.
Exactly. Yeah. So eventually, actually, it was a French person who published a book called The Art of Porcelain. And then finally everyone was like, oh, that's how to do it. Having gone to all this effort, the European porcelain makers actually decided just to stick with their stuff, even though they knew the Chinese secret. So that's why we have Josiah Spode, Stoke-on-Trent and English bone china as being like such a sort of quintessentially British item, because it sort of lost its Chinese roots after a while, because it all just became quintessentially British
Chinese porcelain cup containing quintessentially British Indian tea leaves, the empire.
Exactly. And made, you know, the sort of blue and white porcelain wares, the sort of very traditional stuff, that blue came from the Middle East, basically. Is the sort of the Arabic empire combined them materials expertise with the Chinese stuff to make blue and white porcelain. So yeah, it's pretty much nothing to do with us apart from the fact that we stole it from everyone as usual. And then the final worst material or worst craft really is sugar. And again, you know, sugar is a material. It was invented, the extraction of sugar from sugarcane came from India. The word for sugar comes from the Sanskrit for grit, which is sakara. So they sort of invented this process of extracting sugar from sugarcane, granules from sugarcane. And it was used sort of throughout the Roman Empire kind of area and time as sort of like a culinary oddity, really. It was kind of used as a fine spice, occasionally medicinal, for medicinal reasons, but it wasn't really used as we consume sugar in its multitudes today. And then that sort of all changed when Christopher Columbus took sugarcane to the Americas, and the climate there, it just absolutely thrived. And of course, the end of that story is that the sugarcane plantations in America thrived. The transatlantic slave trade was essentially fueled partially by this material of sugar and the Europeans' sort of craving for it, their absolute love for this material. A lot of the wealth of the inventions from the Industrial Revolution that I talk about in the book, you know, steel, eventually plastics, all this sort of stuff, that was directly fueled by the transatlantic slave trade, which was making sugar. For 300 years, sugar was sort of one of the main driving forces behind the slave trade. And eventually, of course, it ended with abolition, which was really influenced by sort of the writings, really, of currently and formerly enslaved people who sort of wrote about the conditions, sort of exposed what was going on. And then it was one of the earliest examples of, I suppose, consumerism, really, because once people in Europe sort of caught wind of exactly how this product was coming onto their sort of tea tables, they started to boycott it. And when they boycotted it, that sort of disrupted the trade.
Was it sugar that was the primary material on plantations then, or was it cotton? Because I guess Hollywood has made me think that it was cotton that was the primary thing growing. But you're suggesting that it was sugar was the real culprit.
I mean, I don't have the exact figures of sort of how it all broke down, but sugar certainly was a huge one. Cotton, coffee,
and a lot of those are driven by, you know, and well, like certainly sugar and coffee aren't essentials, so it's driven by, like you say, a new sense of consumerism and a new sort of accessibility of luxury.
What you're really suggesting is that when America and Britain abolished slavery, they should also have abolished sugar.
Well, that was one option. Like that was something that could have happened. Really? But as it was, what happened was during the Napoleonic Wars, I think it was Britain cut off imports to France of sugar. So the French had to suddenly, because they were all addicted to this stuff, they had to find an alternative source that wasn't sort of coming from the Americas. And so they invented the method of extracting sugar from sugar beet, which is like a big, disgusting, ugly turnip that grows fine on the fields of Europe. So they were the ones that sort of developed that process. And today, sugar is made sort of equally from sugar beet and sugar cane.
Oh, wow. Is working with sugar, because obviously, like, sugar crafting is like a big skill. That always seems to me like...
Yeah.
Anytime you watch Bake Off, anytime they're told to do anything where they've got to like shape temper chocolate or like work with sugar, you're like, oh, sit back and watch the fireworks now, because... Why is sugar so difficult to work with?
That's a great question. I think it's very difficult to work with. It's got a very sort of in the melt. It's both viscous and extremely hot and extremely sticky. So I think it's very difficult sort of to wrangle itself. Also, it goes through the sort of caramelization reaction at certain temperatures. And I think after that, it's very, very quick to burn. So there's a very tiny working window with sugar, after which time it like blackens and burns and becomes terrible. Yeah, I think it is very difficult to work with. Also, sugar as a molecule is hygroscopic, which means that it loves to absorb water. So you know how soluble sugar is in tea. You can get like, if you wanted to fill your teacup up with 50% sugar and the rest water, all of that would dissolve. Sugar loves water and water loves sugar so much. And as a result of that, if you just leave sort of sugar sculptures on a cake in the air, then it will all absorb all the water from the air and then start wilting. So when you see those sort of, you know, on Bake Off, when they make these sort of like stained glass windows in a in like a gingerbread church or something, that's a different kind of sugar, which isn't hygroscopic and won't wilt.
Crafty bakers. Wow. Well, you've presented us paper, porcelain, and sugar. What's your feeling for which of those three is the worst craft to work with?
I mean, I feel like we should discount sugar because it's not so much the craft, it's more like the sort of the dark history of the material. So I'm going to say porcelain.
Excellent. Any particular reason why you favour porcelain?
Oh, God, it's just such a pantomime of a like diabolical history. And for what? Like just some dainty sort of teacup. Yeah. Like, really, was it worth it?
Give me a Sports Direct mug any day.
Exactly.
Never give me a Sports Direct mug.
I read a little bit about knitting. The longest knitted scarf in the world, knitted by an individual, was 4,565 meters and 46 centimeters long, knitted by a guy called Helge Johansen in Norway. It was measured on the 12th of November, 2013. He'd been working for 30 years on it. That length for 4,500 meters or so, it's 550 London buses stuck end to end. Or if you like, the entire length of Central Park in Manhattan. He unraveled his scarf, which he usually keeps wrapped around a massive spool in a sports center in Oslo, snaking it around in tight loops for the Guinness World Records to measure it. But that is nothing compared to the longest scarf knitted by a team, because there are separate records. The longest scarf knitted by a team. Anyone out of a guess? So he knitted just 4.5 kilometers worth. What do you reckon a team managed?
How big's the team?
Oh, well, I don't know the exact numbers, but then volunteers, friends and supporters of T. Hafen, the children's hospice in Wales, worked on it.
I reckon that a team managed to do a marathon. I'm going to say 26 miles.
That's good.
What's the marathon in kilometres? That's about 40 odd, is it? Yeah, 40 something, yeah.
40 kilometres. Yeah, I'm going to say 100 kilometres.
Ben's closer, 54.29 kilometres.
Amazing.
Long, 33.74 miles. And like I said, it was made by these volunteers for this children's hospice. Work started in May 2002 and it was measured at the Millennium Stadium in Cardiff on the 23rd of June 2005. They might have, nice. That took, yeah, over 3 years. They might have been a bit quicker if they were assisted by the world record holder for the most stitches knitted in 1 minute. That's one Miriam Tegels from the Netherlands, who's hand knitted 118 stitches in 60 seconds. I'm no knitter, but I get the feeling that 2 stitches per second is very fast indeed.
Yep, it is.
And I know that you've also worked with the WI, Anna. The most people knitting simultaneously, the WI set this record with 3,083 people knitting in one single location.
Amazing.
Which is, but if you want a record, you can try and match. The most people crocheting in one location, which is different to knitting, mm-hmm. is 485, set at the American University in Nigeria in 2015.
No bar.
Yeah, quite low. And the world's largest knitted sculpture is a 61-metre pink knitted rabbit, which was placed by the Gelatin Collective of Austria on the side of a mountain in Piedmont in northern Italy, using 1,000 kilos of wool, and took more than a year to make. I've seen a photo of it from above. It looks like God has smited some like terrifying hell rabbit that was rampaging through the Alps.
It feels like that's what they were, what Monty Python were originally aiming for in the Holy Grail.
Yeah.
100%.
It's worth mentioning the arts and crafts movement as well, because crafts as they are now are sort of the arts and craft movement grew out in the British Isles, particularly as a response and a reaction against the Industrial Revolution, in a way that they felt industrialization had sort of moved people away from traditional craftsmanship. It had impoverished people who were skilled in very, you know, ancient skills. It all ties into the love of medievalism and folklore that you get in the late medieval period as well, in the late Victorian period as well. But you get the likes of William Morris and Pugin and John Ruskin and Charles Rennie Mackintosh all trying to bring back traditional skills. Morris particularly believed that in creating beautiful, well-made objects could also be useful as well. So you're like, you've got to make lovely wallpaper, but it's also got to be wallpaper. But there's no reason it can't be beautiful and handmade and be artisanal. He'd fit in very well in Hackney, I think, these days. But yeah, they wanted to... Morris... I don't know what the William Morris setup is now. I imagine they have a massive factory. But William Morris particularly wanted manufacturing based on small-scale workshops to return. So yeah, it was all of these sort of crafts that are old skills, they were being supplanted by the Industrial Revolution and the likes of Morris and so on, pushed back against that. I don't know how they'd have felt about the world's largest ball of paint, which is a craft in of itself. This has been cared for and created by Mike and Glenda Carmichael in Alexandria, Indiana. For 36 years, they have been painting. It started as a single baseball with one single layer of paint, and they've kept layering a layer of paint on top of it day after day and year after year. It has now approximately 23,400 layers of paint and it weighs over 4,000 pounds in weight. It's enormous. Like, there's a picture of him with like a wallpaper roller sort of paintbrush standing beside this ball, which is pretty much as big as him now.
I didn't realise that was a thing.
Yeah,
Is that a craft to paint balls?
Well, apparently so. It wasn't even the first one. He had made one beforehand. He made one previously. I think he stopped at like 1,000 coats or something and gave it to a friend or something, and it ended up in a museum. And I think sort of people were interested in him doing it again. When it was at 20,500 coats of paint, that is enough paint to draw the middle line on a road down 68 miles of road.
Wow.
Yeah, it's now 3,000 layers more on top of it. In fact, you can book by emailing or phoning to set up an appointment to view the ball of paint and add your own layer of paint to it if you would like.
Nice.
This feels like someone who doesn't have access to elastic bands.
Yeah, oh, certainly.
Yep.
Then I found other interesting balls to look at. And then I got back to researching the podcast. Now, I found the Japanese art of mud polishing, or Hikaru Dorodango, which are balls of mud, which you mold into absolutely perfect spheres, and you dry them, and you polish them to a really like astonishingly shiny luster. And it's really, apparently it's quite a simple process, but the results are unbelievable. It was apparently it was a traditional, very ancient art, and it was dying out. And then this guy called Professor Fumio Kayo of the Kyoto University of Education sort of took it up as a way of trying to study psychology during children's play. And in the course of that, he developed a very simple technique for making Dorodango. And he's helped revive and extend the interest in it again. It's quite simple. So you get some mud, and in a clean container, you get some dirt rather, and you add some water to it in a container, and you make the mud, and you make a consistency like cookie dough, apparently. And then you grab a little handful of it and mold it into a sphere, squeeze out as much of the water as you can, and eliminate any of the irregularities, make like the core of it. And when it becomes tacky, you start grabbing the other bits of mud and layering it on top and running your hand through it and getting all of the particles out and going layer by layer, building up this shell. And then you polish it and dry it and get all of the moisture out. Make sure if you can do that. And you polish it. Some of the pictures of it, you can go and look up some of the stuff online. They look like glass or marbles. They're astonishingly beautiful, some of them. I mean, depending on the impurities in them or the moisture, and they can have like different sort of puckering effects or slightly cracked shapes or very smooth and very shiny. But the thing I like most about this is that in an episode of Mythbusters on the Discovery Channel in 2008, the host investigated the truths behind everyday sayings, including the saying "one can't polish a turd," and they did some Dorodango. They got some. One of the hosts used ostrich's feces, and the other host used lion's feces. You want to guess which of them managed to get the higher gloss? Which feces was the higher gloss when they measured it on using a gloss meter?
What, between a lion and a ostrich?
Yes, the lion's feces versus ostrich. And I'll tell you, 70 gloss units is considered a high gloss.
Are ostriches omnivores or carnivores?
Oh, I think they probably eat a bit of worms and grass. I'm not sure. I think they have teeth, so probably a bit of everything.
In which case, I'm going to say the lion was a higher luster.
Very much so. Yeah, the lion, 183 gloss versus the ostrich's 106. But so, yeah, 70 gloss units is high gloss. The lion, more than twice that. They managed to use Dorodango to create a really shiny ball of lion shit.
Sorry, but I just must say, a normal lion shit, lions don't poo glossy poos. There's not shiny turds across the savannah.
Depends why you're feeding them, I guess.
Glitter.
Yeah, if you're feeding them glitter and marbles, then maybe.
Yes, if my son was in charge of the lion's diet.
Yeah. And I read about Duktigami as well from a book called Duktigami, written in 1999 by a comedian and called Joe Wilson, where apparently duct tape, you can find some of this stuff on the Etsy page you mentioned, Ben. People make origami stuff but out of duct tape instead. So you can buy this book, Duktigami, where this guy Joe Wilson teaches you how to make things like wallets and baseball caps, toilet roll covers, mobile phone covers, brain gear for pets. And he points out that NASA has a policy stating that every space shuttle mission has to carry at least one roll of duct tape. So if it's good enough for NASA, it's good enough for people on Etsy. And the last thing I'm going to tell you before I give you my choice is I read a bit about crochet and celebrity endorsements. Tom Daley, the Olympic diver, is now a massive crochet influencer. He has 2 million followers on his own personal account, but he now has over 66,000 followers on his crochet Instagram account. I think it's Made With Love by Tom Daley or something is the handle. Celebrities, it turns out, love crafts. He is alongside Ella Emhoff. Do anyone know who Ella Emhoff is? She's a model and crochet influencer. She is the vice president of the United States, Kamala Harris's stepdaughter. When she married Doug Emhoff, he had two children already, and Ella is one of them. And she also makes and designs her own ethically sourced cardigans, pants, tote bags and stuff in crochet. Victoria Beckham shared a photo of David hand sewing clothes for their daughter Harper's dolls during lockdown, I believe. And this is the weirdest one. Taylor Swift likes making snow globes out of jars of food.
Yeah.
After emptying the food out, like jam jars.
Oh, right, yeah.
But they're, you know, they're quite recent modern celebrities. But you can get, you know, the likes of Marie Osmond produced a line of quilting machines called Marie Osmond's EM1 Emotions 4x4 Embroidery Machine. Sadly discontinued. Rosie O'Donnell wrote a book, Rosie O'Donnell's Crafty You, as in you for university, where you can make things like bunny pinatas, tie-dye t-shirts, creepy costumes for Halloweens, garlands and Valentine's Day bouquets and so on. And Vanna White, who probably quite familiar to American listeners, Vanna White is on the show Wheel of Fortune. She is the lady who goes and touches the squares which turn around to reveal the letters when you're trying to figure out what the missing saying or phrase is on Wheel of Fortune. Vanna has her own line of acrylic that you can buy exclusively in Joanne Fabrics, which is like a yarn store in America. My favorite one of my favorite celebrity craft endorsement is obviously Nick Offerman of Parks and Recreation fame, who is a very skilled carpenter and woodsman. Not just his character Ron Swanson in Parks and Recreation. Nick genuinely is a really skilled woodworker. His dad and his grandparents were big into it. When he was in Illinois studying in theater school, he was using his skills making scenery and set pieces. And he worked in Chicago. And then when he moved to Los Angeles, he was still using those skills to like make money on the side between acting jobs, building scenery and props. And when he moved to LA, he set up a workshop in a warehouse, and it's still going. You can go to the Offerman Wood Shop in Los Angeles. Their website says, "We like to carve spoons." Anna, they carve spoons. Nice. Chainsaw stumps, plank canoes, keep our chisels sharp with stones, build ukuleles and fine furniture. And apparently Nick's favorite project was called Huckleberry. It's a handmade cedar strip canoe, and I've looked at a picture and fuck me, it's the sexiest looking canoe you've ever seen. I don't know, I've never been tempted to fuck an item of Olympic sport equipment before, but wow, it's a really pretty canoe.
If I had to have intercourse with some Olympic sporting equipment, I mean, the first thing that's come to head is a fencer's mask. I don't know why, but obviously, when I came to completion, it would just sieve it all out.
Would you say on guard before you started?
You'd certainly hear my saber rattling.
But my world's worst craft is working with stripes in the medieval times.
What?
I mentioned zebras earlier on. Basically, I found a book by a guy called Michel Pastoureau called The Devil's Cloth. And let me read you an extract. The Devil's Cloth begins with a medieval scandal. When the first Carmelites arrived in France from the Holy Land, the Carmelites are a religious order, the religious order required its members to wear striped habits, prompting turmoil and denunciations in the West that lasted 50 years until the order was forced to accept a quiet, solid colour. The medieval eye found any surface in which a background could not be distinguished from a foreground disturbing. Thus, striped clothing was relegated to those on the margins or outside the social order, jugglers and prostitutes, for example. And in medieval paintings, the devil himself is often depicted wearing stripes. They did not like camouflage clothes of any type, it turns out. In 1310, in the town of Rouen in France, a shoemaker was sentenced to death because he was caught wearing a striped tunic. And Pope Alexander IV actually forbade the wearing of striped robes by a papal decree. And the Carmelite order didn't abide by it. And the Vatican persisted. And eventually Pope Boniface VIII forbade the wearing of stripes by all Catholic monastic orders around the world without exception. They were so completely against stripes. And no one quite knows why. In the author of this book, Pastoureau, suggests maybe it was like an interpretation of the quote in the Bible from Mark chapter 6, verse 9, for those who are playing along at home. Do not put on two tunics. So they think maybe the two stripes side by side was like a very freely interpreting that verse. They thought maybe that would be breaking that particular biblical edict. Or another suggestion is, it's a more practical one, the striped clothing is camouflaging in a way. Mm. Particularly, I guess, in a more rural setting than and less urbanized time like the medieval times. And so it could conceal the silhouette. And so it was possibly useful for thieves and murderers and people who wanted to, you know, go undercover or do nefarious things without being spotted. So as a result, striped cats, tigers, striped snakes, even hyenas were known to or thought to have diabolical traits. Catholic naturalists apparently ranked zebras as the devils of animals because of their stripes.
they would have hated Newcastle fans in medieval times.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, tout se change. Apparently, stripes sort of came into fashion a bit more during the, you know, the Enlightenment era. But then in the 19th century, for whatever reason, North American prisons made it their go-to uniform. So they sort of, you know, fell back into that. They fell back out of fashion for a period until, you know, prisons stopped using them in the 20th century. But yeah, I think working with the devil's cloth is a pretty scandalous craft. So I'm going to suggest working with stripes in the medieval times is my world's worst craft. So our candidates this week for the world's worst craft are Ben's suggestion of the Etsy hellscape of terrible origami, Anna's suggestion of the Ponzi war over porcelain, and my suggestion of working in Lucifer's Tailors with stripes in the medieval times. Good work all round. I mean, it's very easy to just point and laugh at modern people spending lots of money on stupid things like a bit of tissue paper rolled up.
It is.
So yeah, terrible origami is very tempting. I'm tempted by my own because I quite like the devil's cloth. It kind of fits with the brand of the show in a way that I just find pleasing. And porcelain, you make a strong case, but porcelain's really pretty.
It's really pretty and disgusting underneath, and we've all met a lot of people like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I quite like porcelain. I don't know what it is. I'm sorry. I really like, I think maybe it's because I'm really into the Big Pottery Showdown. I know it's not pottery. It's not the same thing. But I just, all of those, like, it's a genuinely really terrible origami is shit. And working with stripes in the medieval time is quite funny. Porcelain is really quite nice. I think it'd be, did you make porcelain when you were researching the book?
Oh, I haven't actually thrown, I have done throwing on the potter's wheel. I'm very, very bad at it. I think porcelain is probably a bit too valuable for me to have a go at doing that.
Yeah, they wouldn't let you have a crack at it. Yeah. I think I'm going to discount porcelain. Which leaves me with the terrible origami and the stripes. And I think I'm going to go with my own. The devil's cloth just had me hooked as soon as I saw it. And terrible origami kind of made me laugh.
Me too. It's hilarious.
So congratulations me, I guess. I'll be wearing some very slimming, if blasphemous, clothes in celebration.
Yep.
Before we go, I've got to give you some of the best news of the week. And I love this. I don't know if you've seen this, Ben. Tottenham Hotspur have signed a new sponsorship deal with Dulux. Dulux, very well-known paint brand in the UK. And Dulux's iconic branding moment was when they introduced the Old English sheepdog as sort of the image for the company logo, and it features in a lot of their adverts. And so to celebrate, Tottenham Hotspur had the Dulux dog come to the stadium and gave it a tour. And Twitter very obviously sort of started making jokes, as people do when there's a new story, to make jokes about it. So someone, for example, tweeted, "Paint the dusty trophy cabinet," to which Dulux's official Twitter account replied, "Don't be silly, surfaces should be dust free before painting." Someone else tweeted, "Time to paint that trophy cabinet," and Dulux's official Twitter account retweeted a photo of an empty Tottenham Hotspur trophy cabinet with the meme words, "For sale, unused trophy cabinet," and the telephone number underneath. It turns out that someone got called Chris H Football tweeted, "Can the dog play centre back? Dulux's official account. He might do a better job, Chris."
I mean,
wow.
Whoever was running the social media account for Dulux that day clearly was having the time of their life ripping the piss out of Spurs moments after the sponsorship deal had been announced. Before we go, Anna, where can people find out more about you? Where can they buy your book, which is coming out on the 13th of May?
Yeah, you can buy the book in your local bookshop, preferably, or online at any local bookshop that you care to frequent. You can give your money to evil corporations if you like. I'd just be very grateful if you would buy it. But that's my order of preference.
Yeah,
I'm online at Anna Pajowski, which is AnnaPlosajski on Twitter and Instagram. And that's my website as well. So you can look me up.
And you have a podcast of your own as well.
I have a podcast of my own called Handmade, where I interview craftspeople, artists, makers, everybody that has an interest in materials in terms of their sort of hand making.
Brilliant. Yeah. Go check that out. Meanwhile, we're off to find out exactly how many sheep we have to slaughter to make this podcast work. I haven't quite figured out how podcasts work, Ben. You'll have to get your wife to explain it to me in simple terms. Thank you for listening to Westwood Forward, everybody. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Oh, I'll just get the chainsaw. Run.